Welcome to this workshop on climate change and international efforts around that initiative. I'm going to invite you to move forward, to move to the front. Even if you want to leave early, we won't mind if you walk back from closer up, but we'd like you to be toward the front so that we have a sense that we can see your faces as we talk about this important issue. I'm Reverend Carol Houston. I am the president of the International Women's Convocation, one of our internationally oriented organizations in the UUA. We are together today on the day that it has been announced that marriage equality is going to be a reality, is going to be set in law for all states of the Union in the United States. Yes, yes. And as Peter Morales made clear this morning, and as I know from the point of view of the UU ministry, this has been important work for us in the last, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years, even before that. And so this milestone is an important thing for us to celebrate as Unitarian Universalists, knowing that small though our movement might be in comparison with other religious organizations, we were mighty in this bringing this change. And it is wonderful to enjoy the sense that we can move mountains. We can make change. So let's work on making change in other ways as well. In the plenary hall, there is a lot of discussion of making change in Black Lives Matter, in issues for transgender people, and I think that's all important. But can I have a round of applause for making that change in the climate change issue? Let us borrow back some of the energy that we have expended on marriage equality and put it toward this life-saving, earth-saving work. I want to welcome you today on behalf of the Inter-UU organization, the coalition of international Unitarian Universalist groups. I want to list them in no particular order so that you will hear about them. We have a booth, a shared booth area in the exhibit hall, and I hope you will come and find out more about international Unitarian Universalist work. One of the organizations is ICUU, the International Council of Unitarian Universalists, UUPCC, the Partner Church Council, UUUNO, the United Nations office that is doing such wonderful work. We're all doing wonderful work. It's redundant there. UUSC, if you were in plenary, you saw a lot about what they are doing. IARF, the International Association for Religious Freedom, the oldest of these international organizations, and still very, very active in what it does. The Global Alliance to Fight AIDS, and that actually is an organization that is going to sunset itself because the AIDS issue has transformed so much. The global issue, particularly of AIDS, is not as strong, and so they are sunsetting their organization, but there will still be a lot of work within Unitarian Universalism on global AIDS. The UUA International Office, headed by Eric Cherry, is in the coalition. And then my organization, International Women's Convocation, we bring women together across boundaries, international and other kinds of boundaries. We put together ways that women can get to know each other and know their needs, know their empowerment sources, and also be a support to each other. I will talk a little bit more about that toward the end of our time together. We will start the presentations with some specific work and presentation on climate change. And Charlie Miller will start us off from that. And then we will move to three presentations about environmental and climate change work going on in countries where there are Unitarian or Unitarian Universalist congregations and presence. Derek Mitchell will talk about India. Gero David will talk about Transylvania. And then I will join you again to talk about some specific work in Bolivia. So that's the pattern, and we will go without introduction, although I hope each of the speakers, as they begin to speak, will introduce themselves. So, here we go.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for being here instead of listening to Kathleen Dean Moore. If you've never had a chance to go to hear her, find one. She's a brilliant poet, philosopher, and she's speaking to the moral challenge of climate change as nobody else that I know. I was asked, I'm an oceanographer, and my career was spent studying small animals that swim in the sea. And I got all excited about climate change when I realized that a couple of companies wanted to build liquid natural gas plants in the Columbia River and Coos Bay, Oregon, right in the subduction earthquake zone, which we're going to eventually see a class 9 or very large earthquake from, and realized that the tsunami earthquake combination in the presence of a liquid natural gas plant would make a disaster even worse than the disaster would otherwise be. I can really talk into it. Oh. So, I've converted myself, sort of, into a climate guy. And this is about the reality in a scientific sense. I love this aphorism from Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's the TV star on Nova in various places, and he likes to say that even if you don't believe a scientific fact, it's still true. And they're unforgiving. Well, this is the Jim Hansen NASA record of temperature. After he retired from NASA, NASA kept adding to it every year, and this is the data through 2014 for warming over the past more than a century. It's not a simple graph, actually. You can't just average the temperature in Nome from the temperature in Timbuktu, Mali. So each temperature record is averaged and compared to its average for 1950 to 80, which was a fairly stable temperature time around the world. And then those anomalies, those variations from the local means can be averaged. And then you compare those to the global mean for 1950 to 80, and you get this graph. And it says that the temperature average globally has gone up by 1.56 degrees centigrade over just more than a century. And the rate of change went up steeply in 1976. There's no doubt that it is getting warmer. And when they insist on talking about climate change, that's because warming has impacts on an awful lot of other things. Oh, you'll notice that at the very last there, it looks like it's leveling off. Well, that's the heat content of the ocean over a long interval, brilliantly measured over the last 20 years or so by bobbing up and down floats. There's 3,000 or more of them around the world ocean to confirm the trend we'd seen before from rather simpler data. And the reason for using heat content instead of temperature is that the ocean is thermally stratified, and so the average doesn't make much sense, but the heat content does. It's a silly-looking number because units of heat are so small, so you got number of joules with 22 zeros, but never mind. It's going up dramatically. That's 90% of where the heat differential of sunlight coming in minus infrared re-radiation going out that keeps the Earth from simply melting down is going. It's going in the ocean. And that means more evaporation, changes in circulation. Everything about the ocean is changing. Why? There's no question that it's carbon dioxide. This is the Keeling curve. David Keeling taught me chemical oceanography at Scripps when I was a graduate student. He was an awful teacher, but he was a great chemist. And his son, who's an even better chemist, has kept this data coming from Mauna Loa. It's taken about quarter hourly, it's averaged, and you can see it going up. You can see that recently it's not actually exponential, it's just continually rising at about the same rate, which is very high. And Jim Hansen was saying we need to stop around 350 if we possibly can. He said that after we were already past that, but now it's at 400, and by the end of this year, the annual average will be above 400 for a long, long time to come. And there's a lot of warming packed up in that. And why is it warming? The president's science advisor, John Holdren, who's a very bright guy, chooses this graph. And I chose it before I knew he did. And it turns out that this is why scientists think it's CO2. It's a satellite measurement of the spectrum of infrared red radiation coming up out of the Sahara Desert in the middle of the night after the sunshine has stopped warming it up. And if you look at the atmospheric window slot there, it rubs along the black body radiation curve for 47 degrees centigrade. It gets that hot in the Sierra, in the Sahara in the summer. The sand gets really hot. And you expect from physical theory about how much infrared radiation should be coming out in the 15 micron wavelength band that it would go up around the 47 degree curve. No. And we know that that's from CO2. We've known that CO2 absorbs in that band. We didn't actually call it that band at the time. Since 1859, Tyndall learned that heat radiation was absorbed by carbon dioxide, and he anticipated the climate results, and they were more fully worked out by Arrhenius in the 1870s, who thought we should burn a lot of fossil fuel so that his home in Sweden would be warmer. So it's that. That's why CO2 matters. Well, then you'll notice over there to the left, methane, CH4. That is also a very active gas. And the curve isn't so deep because there isn't so much of it, but those individual molecules are even more powerful than individual CO2 molecules, and it's at a shorter wavelength, which is more energetic per photon. So methane also matters a lot. So does water. As it warms up, you get more and more water held in the atmosphere. That means that the water impact on the absorbance goes up. It about doubles the effect of the CO2. So why do we think it's greenhouse gases? There's a couple reasons. Usually what you see is a comparison to models of what the temperature would do if you didn't have the CO2 and increases, and what it does if you do. Well, models, nobody trusts models, but this is a simple observation that at the same time that the lower atmosphere is, the troposphere, is getting warmer, that the stratosphere is getting colder. All these curves, 25, 35, 40 kilometers up, the air, what's left of it up there, is getting colder. And the reason is that if the CO2 and the methane and the water vapor pick the exiting heat up in the lower atmosphere, it's not available to heat the stratosphere, so it cools off. And what happens if a volcano explodes and reflects a whole lot of sunlight from the stratosphere? You then get a cooling moment, and you can see those in the graph. A warming moment, because the stratosphere is then warming. So that's it. If you want lots of science details, I wrote a book about it, booklet. It's back there on the table. I brought about 50 copies. If you want to pay $2 to have one, fine. If you don't want to pay $2, take one with you, but you got to promise to read it. Okay, so global warming, which is climate, the base of climate change, is happening. We know why. And that is as thoroughly, soundly established as the spherical shape of the Earth, evolution, thermodynamics, the germ theory of disease, you name it. So what are the effects? A lot of the global ice stock is melting, particularly Greenland, and that's partly because the Arctic Ocean is melting off almost entirely every year. It gathers more heat because it's dark and the sunlight gets absorbed in the summer, and the outflow from the Arctic Ocean goes along either side of Greenland, which is warming it up, and it's starting to melt very fast. So that picture on your right is chunks coming off at bigger rates. They've always come off, but that's accelerating. And then every summer now we get big pools scattered around the surface of the high ice plateaus in Greenland, and they melt, they fall down through cracks in the ice, opening up into great chimneys, and the water from the melt lubricates the glaciers, which slide out to sea faster. The GLIDE satellites that can measure the mass of the ice in Greenland say that the fall off in Greenland ice mass is accelerating. Where does it go? It goes in the ocean, it spreads out, and the sea level rise effects are visible in the United States. This is a storm rise in Norfolk, Virginia. And our two major climate agencies in the government have different guesses of how fast it's going to go during this century. NASA says a rise over the century will be about 3 feet. Goodbye, Miami. And NOAA thinks it could be 6. And if all of southern Greenland melts, it could be 7 meters. What are the effects? Well, California drought right now is supposedly, based on proxy data, about the worst in 1,200 years, and the state is on fire. In Colorado, the pine bark beetles are no longer killed by very cold winters. They take about 10 days of 10 below or lower temperatures. So they've killed all the pine trees on the mountains. It's astounding to see that. And it looks just like this picture, mile on mile on mile. It will be replaced by aspens or something. So we have more and stronger hurricanes, tornadoes, torrential rains. In 2012, I sat in my car in Northfield, Minnesota. I was at a college reunion, and I had to sit there because it was raining so hard. It let up in 45 minutes by the clock. 8 inches of rain had fallen. And we've just had storms like that in Houston. They're happening all the time, all over the world. Droughts and crop failures, forest and prairie fires, coastal storm surges, Hurricane Sandy, extreme winters. Extreme winters are a product of global warming. The Arctic warms more than the tropics, so the heat gradient to drive the jet stream is less than it used to be. When the jet stream goes slower because the gradient is smaller, it can sag more. So it's gone down into Texas, which gets Minnesota winters, and it's ugly stuff. Expanding tropical biota, the Anna's hummingbird stays here. It doesn't have to go back to California anymore. We're having lost habitat. The pictured polar bears are not a joke. And diseases coming north, you want to have dengue fever? Well, why not? There are millions already of environmental refugees. Bangladesh in particular is being flooded by rising sea level, and the people whose farms are now ankle deep and waist deep are leaving, and they're trying to get across India and onto the Mediterranean, go to Italy. The Syrian war is partly the result of a drought disaster. It's just ongoing and will get bigger. There are also the potential for feedback loops and tipping points. Albedo loss, we'll show that in a second. Methane reservoir release, deep ventilation stopping. And I think the biggest potential for a feedback to make things happen faster and worse is that the corporate response to recognizing that fossil fuel asset stranding is about to happen. They know that climate change is about to happen. And what's their response? We're going to dig it up and we're going to burn it now so that it appears as money in our bank accounts. It's a huge feedback effect. Arctic albedo flip is that 90% of the light used to be reflected back to space that comes into the Arctic Ocean in the summer. It melts off. Now more than 90% is absorbed. Everything gets hotter faster. Greenland melts. The Siberian larch used to lose all its leaves in the winter so that the snow on the ground reflected light back to space. Now we got pine trees. They're dark. They stay dark. The permafrost is melting. It opens up puddles filled with organic matter laid down over long, long periods. And when that rots, it's happening in low oxygen habitats, and bang, you get lots of methane. And methane is a powerful, powerful greenhouse gas. Dying forests, everywhere the forest fires are going. That turns them from a carbon source into the atmosphere where they used to be a sink. And up until the late 90s, forests across the North, Canada, Scandinavia, were net positive growth. We've lost that. There's just not enough rainfall there to stop it. This is a more complicated story that if we stop the circulation, the vertical circulation of the ocean, because the Gulf Stream no longer gets refrigerated enough to sink in the Arctic Ocean, the whole oceanography will change. And if you want to talk about that later, look me up. And here's this thing about the corporate response. We've had no comprehensive regulation of carbon dioxide production since this famous court case, Massachusetts versus EPA in 2007, said that the EPA should regulate carbon dioxide. It's not happening yet. Then we got this export of fossil fuels. Right here in town, we have at least one, often two, trainloads, 100 car trainloads of Bakken crude going through in DOT 111 exploding train cars every day. And that's just before they start to do what they want to do, which is 5 to 8 times that. Very dangerous. It's up 2.5 times in the last 3 years. Liquid natural gas is a tempting export item. Powder River Basin coal is another export item. These tankers are gargantuan, and the LNG terminals are very risky. Oregon becomes the target for getting this stuff out because we got the Columbia River, we got good ports, but we also have very weak environmental regulations compared to California and Washington, and we have a very small congressional group. We need more. Do we want more people in order to have more congressmen? I don't know. There are lots of local uprisings around this. This is a protest we had about using the Columbia for fossil fuel export in 2013. It was a lot of fun. We were out on the bridge going to Washington and Portland, and under the bridge, and coal, oil, gas, none shall pass. It was organized by Rising Tide. I've counted up. There are at least 15 state organizations busy fighting this export process. And on the 26th of May, we had a huge, it was a festival really, but complaining about natural gas exports. And it was in front of the courthouse. And the request was to ask the governor to do what the state regulations allow to stop this thing. She didn't do it yet, so the things she could do have been put off another 6 months. But at least the people are up in arms, and maybe we'll get something done. We hope so. It's got to come from the grassroots. Our Congress is owned by the people who want to do these exports, and it's got to come from us. Thanks.
We will move to international stories now, but I just wondered if there are maybe two or three clarifying questions about this material that you might want to ask. The microphone out in the middle is for that purpose of asking questions. Brief questions, and then we'll move on to other speakers.
Here's one.
Could you say a little more about the Supreme Court ruling, the 2007 that you mentioned? I'm not sure I got that. Right.
It wasn't Supreme Court. It was a U.S. federal court that decided the EPA could regulate. But Supreme Court and legislation have huge impacts on this stuff. For example, in 2005, we had an act which said that any impacts of on the Clean Water Act regulations from fracking were simply null and void. You could do anything with water you needed in order to frack for oil and gas. And bam, the whole story went wild. It went everywhere. Yes?
Natural gas has a lower carbon footprint than fuel
source. Do you have thoughts on that? The question. I'm repeating the question, yes. He says methane has a lower impact on carbon into the atmosphere than coal. So coal is all carbon, and from when you burn it, you get all carbon dioxide. When you burn methane, you get much more energy per unit carbon because you're burning 4 hydrogens. And actually, there's a whole lot more what chemists, thermodynamicists call free energy from burning a methane than from burning a carbon in coal. But any methane that gets away before it gets burned has a huge impact, and all fracking leaks terribly. A brilliant woman chemist from NOAA has shown that in LA Basin, the leak rate is 17% of the production across the Colorado Front Range basins. It's 4%. It's actually worse for carbon dioxide equivalents than coal. And the liquid natural gas, well, when you frack, one of the components of fracking fluid is acid. You put acid down in the rocks. I don't care what kind of rocks it is. You're going to dissolve carbonates, and they're going to give you carbon dioxide. So fracking gas comes up. A lot of fracking wells have a CO2 methane separator on the top. Where does that CO2 go? Into the air. And when gas comes by pipeline to Coos Bay, they're going to find they have a variable amount. 4 to 20% of the gas getting to the liquid natural gas manufacturing plant will be CO2, and the first machine is a separator that takes it off. It's
one more question at this stage, and then we'll go to Derek.
I can answer at too great a length.
Okay, you had mentioned how many organizations are fighting this, and how do we find out who they are and how to connect with them? These are, you use this as Judy Sawyer down in the corner from our Eugene church, and those are a bunch of Eugenians in there. Anyway, we need to get together to do this. How are we going to do that?
Well, why don't you talk to me about it? They're in Eugene, for example. There's a no LNG group centered there, and there are Rising Tide and 350 Portland and 350 Corvallis and 350 Salem, and we're all actually talking together, so we sort of have a 350 Oregon. That's a source you can go to get at the others. There's carbon tax groups. There's all kinds of groups. I can't list all 15 off the top of my head. Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's just go for it, all right? It's as simple as that, if we can find. Now you're on and I'm not.
Do you want to introduce yourself one more time?
No, he's Charlie Miller, Charlie Miller.
Hi, everyone. My name is Derek Mitchell, and I'm the director of the Holding India program. It's a program that was created by the Unitarian Universalist Association in 1984. So last year was our 30th anniversary. And we are an organization that stands in solidarity with oppressed peoples and marginalized groups in India. We're a grant-making program. We provide other forms of assistance. We work especially with groups that are branded as untouchables, groups that are of India's indigenous peoples called the Adivasis, and with women's rights organizations. Our first grant in 1984 was to a women's labor union that today has 2.2 million members. So we've really seen a great amount of change in that time. And what we're seeing especially today around India are the causes of climate change and the impact that those causes have, the variety of causes that we see on people in India, on various communities. India has 13 of the world's 25 most polluted cities. 13 of the world's most 25 polluted cities are in the country of India. In the city where I've lived for much of the last 14 years, it's a very special day when you can see a bright blue sky like we have outside today. It's hard to even remember it. Oftentimes, you can't even see a couple of hundred feet in the distance clearly because of the amount of smog and haze. And the reasons for that are varied, but the impact is very clear. Half of Delhi's children, 2.2 million children, have irreversible lung damage as a result of this pollution. So we know the impact on bodies, the question of the impact on the skies and the environment and the larger impact on our Earth. Unseasonal rains we've been seeing increasingly in India, and you know, for most of us, when it rains a little bit more, it's an inconvenience. We can't get to work, or it's a little harder to get to work. But for a farmer, as most Indians still continue to depend on agriculture, it can be devastating. And when agriculture is your only real means of survival, when you essentially depend on that for everything, to run your family, to survive, then it can be entirely destructive. And with a very weak safety net in India, this means that millions and millions of people in India are losing their livelihoods as a result of climate change. Himalayan glaciers are melting The Himalayan glaciers are melting at rates that become increasingly alarming. And for most people, the way they experience that are floods or water being there at different levels than they've expected for years and years and years. And so, again, this nature that people live in such deep connection with in order to manage their survival, in order to earn their livelihoods, all of these ways of surviving are being disrupted. In the eastern part of India, near the city of Kolkata today, there's a region called the Sundarbans, and that's the largest mangrove forest in the world. It's part of it is in India and part of it's in Bangladesh. And that region is increasingly submerged. It's increasingly underwater today as sea levels rise and as people have nowhere to go. They end up in the cities. They end up the prey to traffickers, human traffickers, traffickers of children. So, you know, we see more and more impacts that come out of, more and more negative impacts that arise from these kind of environmental changes, these profound environmental changes that people are seeing. But as you all know, India is an extremely impoverished country. And impoverished countries, in order to move out of that, so often look towards industrial development, the kind of industrial development that we've had in the West, as being the answer to poverty and the answer to underdevelopment. The problem is that what is the environmental impact of that same process that we've used here in the West to reach development, economic development? So the government of India continues to follow that route of development, and the key of that is electricity. We can't really have industrial development of the scale that we've seen in other parts of the world without electricity, but 63% of India's energy still comes from coal. And so that obviously, as a direction towards electrifying the country, is going to have a dramatic impact as more and more of that coal is pulled out of the ground. 27% of India's coal reserves actually come from one state in the country. It's a state called Jharkhand. It's a beautiful state covered in forest. Jhar means forest and Khand means place. So place of forest is where all of that coal resides. The government wants to dig it out of the ground. Companies want to dig it out of the ground. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people living there, many of whom are indigenous people. So again, we see this larger impact that the coal is pulled out of the ground. It ends up in the sky. The result of that ends up in the sky. We all feel it everywhere in the world. The people who feel it first are those who, even before that coal is burnt, are displaced from their lands to dig that coal out of the ground. So I think, you know, in our program, we're always thinking about all of the different stages in climate change and what it means and environmental impact. And the first one that we really work on is, how do we work with the communities and be in solidarity with the communities who are saying that we want to keep this coal in the ground and we want to keep our lands, we want to keep our farms, we want to keep our ways of life. We work very closely with those who are engaged in those struggles, and it is extremely difficult, and they face the entire global capital structure against them in those struggles, but they continue. And I think that another thing that we've really noticed in recent times is this challenge around these are mines in Jharkhand. You can see they're very bizarre places. I don't know if any of you have ever been to an open cast coal mine, but entirely different than the underground coal mining that we often see. You walk and you're in the forest, and all of a sudden the forest clears, and it's as if something like the Grand Canyon is in front of you that was created by human beings. It's incredible to think this is possible, and this is in the state of Jharkhand here, and you see these three kids sitting on the edge of a massive coal mine. You can see the mine in the distance. And, you know, their village was once where this massive, massive scar in the earth now is. So While it's not climate change directly, this is how the people who are experiencing when the coal comes out of the ground are living today. And it's devastating, and those communities are raising their voices and trying to do something about it. So I'll close with one other aspect that I think a lot of us in the West often don't think about, is that, you know, the UN and various entities are trying to come up with solutions to this issue and fighting on it. And oftentimes I think the solutions also don't think of or take into account the communities who live in the places that where the coal is or where the forests are. There's a UN program called Red Plus that it's about afforestation and making sure that the forests remain where they are. And the bizarre aspect of some of these programs, though, is that they financially incentivize people who live in or around forests not to cut those forests, or basically not to touch those forests if the argument is taken to its extreme. And the problem is that for many people who have lived in these forests for generations and generations, to not touch the forest and not go into the forest at all and to be paid not to do that means you're changing your entire way of life that you've lived for thousands and thousands of years. On the one hand, you have logging companies and you have all of these other forces that are devastating massive, massive forests. And then you have tribal peoples and indigenous peoples who live in the forest. They may cut a few trees from time to time in order to build a house. And we're telling them, here, take this cash and don't cut one or two trees a year so you can build your house. And change your entire way of life so that we can all be better off. And I'm just, you know, oftentimes these programs are conceived, and I think they're ill-conceived in many ways, and end up affecting the small group of people who will be most devastatingly affected by the work that these larger logging companies, who are going to buy those carbon credits as a result of those tribal people not cutting down their small bits of forest. So I think that what we've learned in our program is it's so important to keep in mind those people who are most worst off in all of these situations, those who are going to be most devastatingly impacted by both our mitigation strategies and also by the impacts of climate change at the larger level. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is David, Gheru David. I am a Unitarian minister from Transylvania, Romania. Also one of the leaders of our denomination in Transylvania. English is my third language, so if there's something doesn't make sense, please bear with me. My native is Hungarian, and I also speak Romanian, which is the language of the country where I come from. I am here to talk to you about the involvement of my Unitarian denomination, the Hungarian Unitarian Church, in a civil campaign protesting against the mining business of a multinational giant who plans to use cyanide in the mining process in a beautiful forest in my home country, Transylvania. The name of the project is Roșia Montana Gold Project, Gold Mining Project. Roșia Montana in Romanian means red forest, red mountain, more exactly. The name comes from the color of the stones that they are planning to remove in the mountains. Roșia Montana is a 2,000-year-old mining settlement established by the Romans, who built the first mining business in the area to take away the gold and the silver of the mountains. But the business went on for 2,000 years. It first became a Hungarian state business, since Transylvania was part of Hungary for most of its history. And today is a Romanian state mining business because we now belong to Romania. The problems started when the Romanian state sold the business 15 years ago to a multinational mining company called Gabriel Resources. And they established a Romanian corporation called Roșia Montana Gold Corporation. And the plan is, to give you some facts, to empty 5 villages, displace 2,000 people, take away 9 sanctuaries, parish houses, social halls, public institutions, schools, hospitals, cemeteries, in order to remove five huge mountains to make a similar scene that you saw from Derek in India, except this is not a coal mine, it is a gold mine. It looks the same. They slowly take away the mountains and create this huge, cannot imagine how huge, holes in the ground to take away the purpose is to take away the 300 tons of gold. I made a quick estimate. In pounds would be 600,000 pounds of gold from that mountain. Now, our problem with this process going on for 15 years is a community problem for the reasons that I mentioned. Villages, communities, people are being moved against of their will from their homes, from their settlements. And the environmental problem is that they want to use cyanide to wash out the gold from the stone. And that cyanide will not affect only the people, well, there will be no people in the region, but will affect everybody in the country and in the countries where the rivers of Romania flow through on their way to either the Black Sea or the Mediterranean Sea. So it is not only a local problem and it's not only a local threat, but it's a national and international threat too. Business started 15 years ago. The corporation started to buy houses and sell and give money to the people and ask them to leave as a choice. And they paid them quite well to choose their location elsewhere. And by this business approach, we now lost more than half of the community already as we speak. So out of the 2,000 people, 1,000 of the people left. They were bought by the corporation, to put it simply. And there is another half, about 1,000 people who are left in the in the town, in the region. The protest campaign of the civil society and of the churches led by the Unitarian Church started early 2014. We were leading this campaign because not only because we too have a congregation and a people and a minister and assets in Roșia Montană, but because our set of values about the endangered reality in the village and our care for the nature were first phrased among the churches, and all the churches joined us, and then we joined together the civil movement in protesting against the next steps. And this step was to change the law in Romania in order to allow the corporation to obtain the environmental authorization for the project. After investing in this place for 15 years, after spending millions of dollars for this project, they don't have an environmental authorization for the government. But they went ahead anyhow because they were sure that the 300 tons of gold means a lot more money, and they were sure that they will obtain at the end the authorization from the government. Well, they didn't at this stage because the protest of the civil society was so successful that the parliament did not pass the law allowing the authorization to be issued for the cyanide technology. This was a one-year campaign, and it grew gradually. In November and December 2014, the Unitarian Church did a national-wide campaign where every weekend for 4 weeks, we went, our congregations, our people, rented buses. We went to the village, to the town, which is in the center of the country, and had a worship service every night in the Unitarian Church, being joined by other fellow religious people in the community and other protesters who came to support us in our protest. to express our solidarity with the local community and to protest against the political solution for the technical project and technical plans. And in December 2014, the parliament did not vote the law for allowing the cyanide technology. The struggle of the community and the danger for the environment is not over yet. The corporation will look for new ways to obtain the authorization and have a authorization for the project. As I said, they spent millions of dollars already, so they feel they want to try as hard as they can. But I think that the awareness of this reality is so strong in Romania, and the civil society is so united against the economical and political campaign of the corporation, that I think they will not succeed at the end. We will stay close by the community, and we will continue to care and do our protest. Environmental issue in this place is not the main responsibility of the church. The church is there to support people in their daily lives. But in this particular case, the two realities go together. So when we do support the anti-cyanide technology project, we do our church work for our people and for the people in the region, for the other people in the congregations. So this is why we think, while theoretically this is not the primary responsibility of the churches, in reality it actually is a primary responsibility. Thank you very much, and after the presentation, I'm happy to answer your questions if you had any.
A solid success story, and we promised you success stories on the international stage. And I have another story that, if I stop at a certain point, will be a success story. It's not my story. This is from Bolivia. I have not visited Bolivia, although I intend to visit there in November, along with other Unitarian Universalists from this country and from Europe and Australia, other parts of the world, as the International Women's Convocation takes a group to Bolivia for a gathering in association with women in Bolivia. We have an informal Unitarian Universalist congregation there, people that consider themselves Unitarian Universalists working by UU principles. The leader of that group is Olga Flores. You may have seen her. She has attended a couple of general assemblies in the last few years. She's a powerful speaker. I wish she were here to tell the story, but it is a story that's still unfolding. The story, just briefly, is about the Tipnis Highway protest. When Evo Morales came into the presidency of Bolivia as the first indigenous president, there was high hope for what he would bring to the country, recognizing indigenous rights and other things as well. The constitution that he helped draft, that was passed in 2010, included environmental, ecological elements. There were promises that the country was making to its people that they would be an ecological country. But then the plan came forward to build a highway from the Amazon up to the Andes, up to La Paz. A large part of this highway would go through indigenous territory, and indigenous people were not asking for this highway. It also would open the door to deforestation. That would be one of the major reasons for the highway to get into the forest and to get trees out of it. Brazilian funding was promised, and plans went forward. But then the protests began, and the protests were large. The protests were organized over long stretches of the area that was going to be taken over for this highway. And the protests received violent response. In the fall of 2011, there were violent beatings of protesters. There were injuries. There were children beaten, mothers and children separated. Terrible, terrible scenes of police violence against the protesters. But they persisted. The protesters persisted, and by 2013, there came the word from the government that the road was not going to be built. The project was put on hold, the Brazilian financing disappeared, and all seemed to be well for a time. And if you want a success story, there's one. But then we go forward. And frankly, when it was announced that the road was not going to be built, it was simply a temporary hold. Morales said that he wanted to work on lifting people out of extreme poverty, and his promise to the indigenous people was that he would do that before he reconsidered the road project. And he would give that 3 years. 3 years isn't even up, but in early June, it was announced that TIPNIS was back on the schedule for the government. That there would be, well, he's trying to say that the funding will come internally. There is some sense that there's Chinese funding coming in now for the building, and thus for what will happen from the road in taking the timber out. At the same time, it's been announced that other areas in the country, and part of TIPNIS is national park area, not only indigenous area, it's national park, but they are opening up other national park areas, other government-owned areas to natural gas and coal mining. Oil and gas, I guess, not coal. So it is not a success story anymore. It is something that has the women that we are in touch with in Bolivia very upset, they have to start again, and they're not hopeful that they will be able to turn this around again. But they will start again. They're a determined group. And as I say, we are going down there with Unitarian Universalists. We are not going down there to lead or even suggest what they should do. We are going down there to listen to what their responses are to what's happening and try and support them, help them as we can. But this is their struggle. And as Derek was speaking and David, it's always the struggle to make sure that the people own what they have, that they own their land, that they make those decisions about where they are. In this case, this is about indigenous rights. It is about the rights of people to the land that they have controlled for forever. But there's definitely an environmental aspect to it, because deforestation of that land will inevitably be the result of that. So there are our stories. We welcome questions for any of the three of us. I will tell you, for one thing, the description in the in your book talked about pairwise rankings as a decision-making process, and that is a way that many of our international groups use to listen to communities and help the communities listen to themselves and figure out what their priorities are, how to set their priorities amongst their land rights, amongst the jobs and the environment. If you go to your app, your GA app, and find this workshop, number 310, you will find something about pairwise ranking. We decided not to take the time of this workshop to talk about it, but there's a rundown on this kind of decision-making process in there. Also, a few other flyers. You will see this in your app, and this is about gives you a key to going down to Bolivia for the gathering. And if anyone wants to consider doing that, that is in November, second week in November. International Women's Convocation executive directors in the room. Jofi, would you stand up? And you may speak with her about joining us. We do have some spaces left on that trip. All right, I see people lining up for questions. I think we can just sort of pass the microphone along to.
Hello, can you hear me? My name is Laura Nagel. I'm a delegate from Monterey, California, UU Church of Monterey Peninsula. And I want to thank Carol and David for those success stories. I want to challenge the other speakers to talk about strategies that are working as those, particularly for those most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. Specifically, I would like to know, Derek, what is being done in India to switch to alternative fuels. Dr. Miller, with respect, I think your undocumented assertion that corporations are increasing biofuels extraction is alarmist and therefore unhelpful. I believe that the changes to alternative fuels and energies are happening, but they will take time, and I challenge us to focus on priority areas of threat where folks who have the least and are most vulnerable as we move away from biofuels to solar, geothermal, and wind sources of power. Thank you.
Okay, I'll start here. Well, the government of India is certainly investing in a number of different alternatives, like hydro, especially hydro, wind, solar. The challenges that come up are, in theory, all of these are critical sources of energy that the government should develop. The problem is, once again, in all of these processes, there are losers. And so it has not been without great conflict that these new sources are also being brought. So essentially my point is that there are no easy solutions, and many, many people, while yes, we want to look after the most impoverished and most marginalized, oftentimes regardless, they are forced to sacrifice by losing their villages to dams that are created for hydropower, by losing their lands, which are where they send their cattle, for where solar is being put up, windmills, also the same thing. So in all of the alternatives and the processes that are going forward to create those alternatives, there are great struggles in India right now, in addition to the struggles around people being displaced for coal mines. And so, yes, Laura, people are working, the government is working on those issues, but unfortunately, it has not been without great conflict.
Well, I think you made a statement, not asked a question. And yes, we are doing very well at getting solar and wind power going. I have a 3.5 kilowatt solar system on my house, and I no longer pay a power bill except for $10 a month to stay connected to the power grid. And many, many people are doing that in my town. A woman there is leading an effort called Seeds for the Soul, S-O-L, Spanish for sun. And people like my wife have given her interest-free loans of $9,000 so that people who have enough money to get an income tax return can get all of the benefits that the government is providing for putting up solar. And then she'll get her money back in about 4 years. And many, many people in Corvallis are making the loans, and many, many other people are putting the solar on. And there's other schemes like that that are working. If you don't believe that the fossil fuel companies are trying to dig up the world and export the product as alternative fuels begin, You haven't seen the list of how much fuel wants to go out the Columbia River. It's terrifying.
My name is Charlie Behrens, First Unitarian Church of Orlando. Orlando, formerly known, or soon to be known, as the Refugee Center for Miami. Isn't it awesome that we have 614 incandescent light bulbs in here? My question is, what kind of things, I appreciate what you've been doing in terms of gas, oil, fracking, coal mines, things like that. What kind of things are you doing to address what the United Nations FAO and World Watch Institute has identified as the leading cause of global warming actions by humans, which is animal agriculture? Are there any actions going on in India or here in this local area to either end animal agriculture or promote vegan eating?
Good question for India, considering how many vegetarians there are. But most Indians aren't actually vegetarian. So, yeah, it's a very interesting point, and to be honest, not one that I hear much about, because you know, when you're driving across the countryside of the United States and you can smell first, but then you see these massive pastures with cows, and then you see the slaughterhouses and all of this sort of thing. It's something you don't see in India, really. People, livestock is generally kept on a very small scale, and as yet it has not been heavily industrialized. So in terms of that being a source of, a great source of methane gas and other climate change causing gases, I don't think it's as much of a concern there, but it's a great question. I'm going to look at that further.
There's many things about animal agriculture to be considered, and there are alternative schemes out there in which it's hoped to convert the annual plant cropping to perennial plant cropping, and to do that you have to mix animal husbandry with the plants so that you get an exchange of nutrient substances, fertilizers, out of the animals into the soil, back to the animals. And I remind you that no organism can digest the cellulosic fibers in grass and convert it to food besides ruminants. And it's ruminants that are the main concern of this world health thing. And it's a very mixed story. And it has all kinds of advantages to include some animal husbandry in the way we do our agriculture, I think. On the other hand, yes, cows belch out 85% of the methane from animals, and it's a problem.
Hi.
Next question. Go ahead.
I'm John Beamer. I'm with the Wyeast Unitarian Church here in Portland. I was kind of disappointed, shall we say. The Constitution in Bolivia and Ecuador are both very pro-environment. I've read those and been very celebratory about those changes, and yet it doesn't seem to be implemented over time. And I'm wondering if there's a systemic piece missing in this puzzle. You know, we seem to have constitutional change at one end, and we have protests at the other end. What's in the middle? What helps this stuff work over time?
Well, in between, in Bolivia is a president who is consolidating power, and who has opted not to follow the dictates of the Constitution in this area. Again, this is not my story. I'll know everything after I visit Bolivia in the fall, but I haven't done that yet. But my impression is, and what Olga and the women around her say, is that he doesn't intend to follow that area of the Constitution, that he is centralizing his power and finding ways to bring a monetary base from the land that will not be ecological. That's what I can say. So the missing piece is the accountability of a government and administration between the protest and the Constitution.
I think the other aspect to that is that laws and constitutions often don't mean much unless people are fighting for them. And so that's really the only hope, and that's the piece in the middle. Is civil society, activists, groups, courts at times when the courts are friendly on these issues, and people pushing and moving these courts to react when the state itself, when the government is working against people's interests. And that's what we certainly see in India, and that's the kind of work we support.
Hi, I'm Connie Young from Fresno, California, UU Fresno. My question is about Citizens Climate Lobby. Are you familiar with that organization, and do you know about any organizing in India, Romania, Bolivia around Citizens Climate Lobby?
One of my friends in Corvallis, Peter Stoll, is the local representative in the Willamette Valley of Citizens Climate Lobby, and he's conducting a very active carbon tax effort, primarily with Congress rather than the local legislature. And there are branches around the state of Citizens Climate Lobby, and they're trying as hard as Citizens Climate Lobby everywhere to get some kind of financial incentive installed for bringing down the carbon output of the fossil fuel burning process.
Right, and they also propose a border adjustment so that other countries will be encouraged to also levy their own carbon taxes. And there are some international chapters of CCL. So I'd hope that you could look into those for your countries as well.
Citizens Climate Lobby works on the model of another organization that I work with, an organization called Results, which sets up chapters and teaches people to lobby their own representatives and senators in the United States, and following a similar model in other parts of the world. And it really can be very effective. It is a gradual, step-by-step process, but you form a relationship with that member of Congress, and you watch them and contact them and move them along to what you need for them to do for climate change and for results. It is about alleviating the effects of extreme poverty. Anybody's interested, ask me about it later on.
Yeah, I can just add, in the Indian context, you know, I think what we're really seeing is that, you know, just thinking about a kind of citizens movement against climate change, we're not really seeing anything like that in the Indian context yet. Usually, solutions to climate change are technological ones that are being imposed on communities, as opposed to communities themselves being aware and understanding what's happening around them, all of these impacts that are as a result of these larger changes, and then from the community themselves, a pressure for that change to be there. That's something that it's just beginning, but we haven't really seen in a big way in India yet.
Hi, I'm Karen Tobin, First Church, Portland, Oregon. And my question's for Dr. Charles Miller. First, I just want to, for those people in the room who don't know Corvallis, it's Oregon State University and has one of the top oceanography programs in the nation. So I'm thrilled you're here. What?
You've seen our advertising.
Yeah, they're awesome. So we're very lucky. And I don't know Dr. Miller, but I'm thrilled he's here. And he's the first person. I've got his booklet here, so I'm going to read this. So my question is for you. This is my second climate change workshop at GA, and the first one, there's an awful lot of emphasis on what individuals can do, solar panels on your house, you know, animal agriculture, all of that. I'm an organic farmer in the suburbs of Portland. I'm doing a lot personally. But my question is, to really move society in the United States, How do we move the corporations? What do you think would work? What should we be pushing our senators and congressmen to do? Is it the carbon? What should the United States do if we could get them to do it? And I know with our president, the present people in Congress, it's a problem, but that's my question.
Well, the president gave a speech about 6 weeks ago to a labor organization saying we shouldn't be moving jobs offshore to Asia or anywhere else, and then promptly requested fast track for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The Trans-Pacific Partnership means that we probably will be exporting everything that can be dug up out of the United States, because we can be sued from anywhere that wants us to do it. And it'll be decided in trade courts, not by our courts. We've just surrendered a lot. What to ask of what,
do you favor a carbon tax? What do you think?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
If we can get it. And the carbon suppliers don't particularly favor it.
All right, last question.
My name is Ruth Subramanian. I'm a member of Northwest Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Atlanta, Georgia. And following up on Derek's comment that in India, there's not much grassroots efforts to solve problems, I just want to mention a book that will be coming out in August about the topic is, it's nonfiction, the impact of technology on the environment in India. It just happens to be written by my daughter. It's coming out the end of August. It's on Amazon already. The short title, nonfiction books have to have a short title and then a long, long subtitle, but the short title is A River Runs Again. And her framework is the five elements, fire, water, earth, air, and the ether, and using that as a narrative. The one on water is where local people realized that the river had stopped running, and they made efforts going back to the old methods that they used to use, and the river runs again. Yeah. So just want to mention that book.
Thank you. Thank you.
Google or Amazon.
I mention the name and the author again, please.
The short title is A River Runs Again. The author is Meera, M-E-E-R-A, Subramanian. But A River Runs Again, that'll get you to Amazon.
All right.
I think that's a fantastic point, in terms of the fact that people are fighting these things the level that they can see. And that's what we see in India often, is that people are fighting for their local river, people are fighting for their local forest, people are fighting for what's around them. And when we think about climate change solutions, and oftentimes it's these mass levels, and that's really where we need to fight it in order to be successful. But what we really see in India is that the way that people are struggling on these issues is when it comes to the forest, the river, the sky, what they can immediately see right around them. And then people will rise up in ways that none of us actually ever see here. So that's where we draw our inspiration, and that's where I think that if all of us did that in our own areas and fought in that way, as I know so many of us and so many in the Unitarian Universalist movement are committed to, we can see real change. So I think in that sense, there's real solidarity between all of us.
Wonderful. Concluding words, Derek. Thank you. David, any concluding words?
Thank you.
Charlie. I would conclude with the idea that this is about climate change, the urgency of doing something about climate change, but I think this panel has also brought the complication of climate justice when we look at situations in developing nations and even in some parts of our own country. It becomes complicated with other issues. But, hey, we got marriage equality. We can do this, right? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That was good. That was good. Good to meet you.
okay after getting a little bit off my chest. I really would like to yell at that guy, but I can sit here. Well, there's a whole big line to do that.
Yeah.
Hi, how are you?
I had to get my change out because I have too big of bills.
Yeah.
There are none back there now. So, is it online somewhere or something?
What,
the book? Yeah, the little booklet that was there.
You need to ask it. Actually, I think it is online. I think
okay.
He told me that. So,
okay.
So where, I don't know. He's over there.
Okay,
so
thank you.
No, I'm in New York. I'm doing this international stuff still and loving it.
Yeah, I paid for one. I hope.
Yeah, no, we didn't order one, and I didn't see one.
So.
one, yeah, E-146 or something like that. Something about UN. That's what I had on my list, anyway. UN Sustainable Development Goals,
Oh, yeah.
Human Rights and Climate Change.
Oh, 145, yeah. Yeah, right.
I'm not going there. I'm